If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch out.
Arr!
It's Space Pirate Radio time here on Astronomy.fm Radio. That must mean it's another Wednesday evening, 9 o'clock, February 8th, 2017, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. And of course, universal time, that would be February 9th, 2017, at 2 o'clock in the morning. So that means we are live, and of course our chat room is open, and that means we're welcoming our crew aboard right now. So if you want to join the crew of Space Pirates, come on over to our chat room at astronomy.fm/chat. So far we've got you and me, Black Projects, Twist Edge, Glenn, Optronics, Plaid Sister, Farley, Plaid Joan, and Plaid Mac. I don't remember Farley here before. Welcome, Farley. Glad to have you here. So we got a few things to talk about tonight. Let's see. Want to do the politics first to get it out of the way?
Yeah.
All right, let's do the politics first, and we'll go from there. Couple things we've got on politics. We usually don't do politics here. We try to keep things neutral, but some things have come up this past week that really need to be talked about, or at least mentioned. A couple of things. If you look on our Space Pirate Radio Astronomy page, you'll see a post by somebody about a person named Pranvera Hysini. She's real famous with Astronomy Outreach of Kosovo, which is a chapter of the Charlie Bates Solar Astronomy Project, our good buddy Stephen Ramsden. So she actually runs one of the divisions of that solar outreach, basically taking telescopes out to the public and to schools and things like that. She does it in Kosovo. She's been on television in Kosovo for all of her astronomy outreach, quite well known well around the astronomy outreach, solar outreach astronomy people all around the country, all around the world, actually. And she wanted to come here and see the solar eclipse. It's like, oh, great. She always promotes America. It's like, show the statue in Kosovo of, Bill Clinton or Carter Clinton, I think, that was part of helping Kosovo get over its conflict there about 20 years ago, about the time she was born or something like that.
Yeah, that's anyways, in the Clinton years.
Yeah, that's it. She wants to come over here to see the solar eclipse. Should be no problem. Well, she went to go apply for a visa and denied.
Yep.
Denied simply on the reason that they said she might want to stay here, so she's not allowed to come in. You know, she spent a month in Australia. I watched her on Facebook taking that whole trip with our good buddy Rob Black down there. He does a radio astronomy program in Australia. Stephen Ramsden has been to Kosovo, again, did television interviews with her in that country. She just wanted to come here and watch an eclipse, but was denied by the State Department because their lame excuse was she might want to stay here. Well, she spent a month in Australia, and she went home. Her family's in Kosovo. She wants to go home after this. It's just a trip, and they deny it. So anybody out there with any connections, or if you don't have connections, if you just don't like that idea, people being denied visiting this country, good people, intelligent people, where we end up with the dregs of society from other countries living here, being imported.
Okay.
We do. Imported into this country. If you don't like that and you just want somebody to visit, why don't you write to your representatives and protest this type of disgrace on our country? All right, it's up to you to decide what you want to do. But more people that complain about this type of way we treat other people, maybe something will actually get done. An unrelated subject. You want to do this one?
Which one?
Well, person from JPL.
Yes. There have been several recent reports of JPL and NASA scientists being given a very rough time going in through airports at TSA or dealing with Homeland Security. So this is from the JPL. Sid Bikanavar is a U.S.-born citizen and a NASA engineer with a valid U.S. passport, and his JPL phone was confiscated by Homeland Security. And it has been returned to him. He is back in his job with JPL, discussing with legal counsel, but it's this is not business as usual.
First, they forced him to give up his access PIN.
Yes.
So they could copy all the data inside of it. The stuff's getting illegal. And if you like that, continue on. If you don't like it, talk to your representative. Do something about it. Be active.
The best way to voice your opinion about anything related to your life in the U.S., if you are a U.S. voter, is to call your representative. I don't care if it's NASA funding, education, or incidents like this. You call them. Don't sign the online petition. Don't send an email. You can, but pick up the phone.
I recommend if you do emails, keep it as short as possible, because we really want a lot of people to complain about stuff like this. So keep it down to one sentence that will probably get read.
And keep it personal. Don't use a form letter. The people reading these in the offices, they know when it's a form letter and they see something about big issue, everybody write your senator about such and such, and they get 500 letters that are all the same text. They know this.
Yeah, they don't read it. So, don't like this kind of stuff that's happening. The only way to stop it is to first complain about it, let your representatives know you don't like this, you're not going to tolerate this stuff, and then after that, I don't know, run for office. Do something more about it.
That is also an option that people are being encouraged to look into.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right, that's what we have so far. Stuff basically related to astronomy and science. Hopefully enough people will complain and get Pranvera to visit over here. And we'll actually get to meet her. I've talked with her on Australia Radio, by the way. And I'm going to get her on our show here, too, sometime soon. All right, let's take a look around. Our usual look at the sun first, real quick. Couple of tiniest little spots. I'd say they look like they're about the size of the moon, all in one group. And not much on the sun. Solar weather's kind of calm and slow right now, so not much going on there. So not much activity for the sun itself. A couple of rocks have been flying by and are still going to fly by the Earth pretty soon. Let's see, one was today. A little less than a million miles away from us, about 60 feet diameter, so nothing really spectacular. Got something coming up on the 17th. This one's about 250 feet diameter. It's going to be about a little more than a million miles away from us. Coming up on February the 23rd, half a million miles away. This one's 300 plus feet in diameter. It's nothing really, really close. Usually about between half a million to a million miles flying by us, and moderate-sized stuff, too. 300-feet rocks are actually pretty big, but pretty far enough away, so we don't really have to worry about them. Something flew by a few days ago, too, about the distance of half the distance to the moon, but it was a small rock. It was about 50, 60 feet in diameter or something like that, so kind of no big deal. Let's see. How about a little rundown of what's going on in the sky? Let's see. February 11th, Saturday. Full moon. Full moon of the eclipse and a penumbral eclipse.
Which is no good. Sorry.
Well this one's not bad.
It's not bad.
This one's not too bad, actually. This is the kind I said, this is the penumbral, kind of a penumbral eclipse that you can actually see something happening. Unfortunately, we're here in the U.S. are not in the prime spot for it, so it's going to be Eastern Europe, Africa, around that region. This is a penumbra There's two parts of a shadow out in space, basically, the umbra and the penumbra. The umbra is the Earth's shadow, the darkest part of the Earth's shadow. And the penumbra is the kind of a partial shadow where some of the sunlight goes around the Earth and it darkens the moon slightly, but not a lot. Well, this is the kind of penumbra shadow that you can actually see, because the edge of the moon is going to be right at the edge of the umbra shadow. So this is the only kind of penumbra shadow that you can actually see an eclipse of. I usually tell people, you know, don't bother. It's only going to be like 10% into the penumbra, and you really won't see anything. Only if you had like a photometer where you might detect a difference. Well, this one, you actually should see a darkening on, I think it's the north edge of the moon. So give this one a shot. But I said you're going to have to be somewhere around Eastern Europe, Africa, or be able to see this one. Here's a link from Sky and Telescope.
Yeah, and it's gotten quite a bit of national coverage, like I linked from the Washington Post.
Well, I've been trying to find a good map, this type of map for it, to show you how close it's actually going to be to the umbra. And this is one that's actually worth looking for.
We also have on the 11th, it is the close approach of Comet 45P. It will be passing by at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is a binocular object, so this is not a dazzling Hale-Bopp Comet McNaught sort of comet. But this should be a fun binocular object. It is decidedly green. At present, it does not have a visible tail. So it is a puffball.
Yes. Because it's mostly traveling straight towards us.
Yes.
So if it did have a tail, it would be kind of directly behind it anyways.
Some photographs did show a very long, narrow tail. But right now, it's a puffball. So I've quite enjoyed puffball comets in the past. So it's definitely worth checking out.
So hopefully you'll be able to see it. I think it's kind of in a lot of twilight, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been a morning object.
Okay.
But it's gotten easier to see over the last few days. Like reports from February 8th, which is the day that we're currently leaving, or just left, depending if you're listening to us in the U.S. or Europe. It was reported as being quite easy to see in binoculars. And quite good in a 10-inch telescope.
There's another one. It's not on the Comet website, which is kind of strange. There's another one actually on the NASA website called Comet 2016 WF9. And I guess it was discovered by Neil Weiss, but it's not, at least in this, most of the stuff I've been looking at, it's not Comet Neil Weiss. There's another Comet Neil Weiss, but let me put this article in our chat room here. Check this out. Let's see. This one's coming around kind of close to February 25th will be its closest approach. It's going to be a distance of 32 million miles from us. So it's about, you know, only one-third of the way from the Earth to the sun. So still pretty far. It's looking like it's dimmer than expected, they were saying. So, it's one to shoot for, and I wonder why it didn't make some of the other comet websites that they usually do. So we'll check out the NASA website for this one. I went right to the homepage. It's one of the articles right on the homepage for this comet. And see if we'll be able to see it. It's interesting. Let's see. A little bit of planets in the sky. Oh, sorry, I started before. Also Saturday, besides the eclipse, there's going to be a Regulus. The moon will be right by Regulus. It's supposed to be Regulus will be 0.8 degrees north of the moon, and there will be an occultation that night. And I looked this one up, and it's not a good occultation for anybody. From what I could tell, the best place to see it will be somewhere around the Antarctic Ocean, between Antarctica and Australia. So not a real good one. And the only other general planet moon close encounter time will be next Wednesday, when Jupiter will be 3 degrees south of the moon. But we can go with what's up in the sky lately, planet wise and stuff like that. Of course,
Venus,
yes, is still there, and it's actually still kind of close to Mars. Looking at my star chart here. So Venus, let me get over here. Venus, Mars, and the planet Uranus are actually pretty close together in the sky right now. Venus, of course, the very prominent one. I think Venus is going to be almost another within a week or so, or week and a half, at its brightest in its orbit. Now, when it's brightest, it's, I think it's, did it say brightest, greatest something illumination? Where was that spot? Venus, greatest illuminated extent. What does that mean? Greatest illuminated extent. Extent would indicate size.
Mm-hmm. Or, surface area.
Maybe surface area. Balancing with the size of how it appears to us in the sky. So, kind of a toss-up there. Because what's happening, well, when Venus comes around from the far side of the sun, it's actually at its farthest point from us. So it's actually kind of small, even though it's a full Venus.
Right.
Then it starts getting less full, becomes waxing gibbous, but it's actually growing larger until it gets to basically quadrature at a right angle to us, and it's about halfway lit up, and it's kind of at a medium size to us. And as it starts swinging in between the sun and the Earth, it gets bigger and bigger, but it also gets to be more and more of a crescent, so it's a waning crescent.
And at a certain point, the two curves cross.
Yes.
The surface area, the illuminated surface area, decreasing as it gets larger to our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And when the disk is about 27% illuminated, you hit that peak illumination.
But I thought its overall brightness is when it's actually kind of gibbous. So it's like kind of big, but a lot of surface area is bright. So
I had always heard in this article from 2012, which is nonetheless the math holds, even if the dates don't, backs me up, that it's when it is in a crescent phase, because you've got that sweet spot between the closeness and the surface area.
Mm-hmm.
So 28-27% illumination.
Okay. So I looked at it, and it's definitely past halfway lit up. It's definitely getting towards the crescent phase. It's arguable whether it's more crescent than anything else, but I guess it'd be more crescent. Getting kind of big. Now, it's actually starting to swing back towards the sun. So we've already reached its maximum elongation. Basically, its apparent distance from the sun as we see it. You'll notice Mars is to the east of Venus, and Venus has gotten already closest to Mars as it's going to get. Several degrees, now it's starting to swing back away from the planet Mars. So the separation between Mars and Venus is actually increasing daily now. And it's getting bigger because it's actually gone around the corner. It's actually circling, coming towards us. As it comes towards us, it also starts to swing between the Earth and the sun. So that means it becomes more and more of a crescent. And it also gets closer to the Earth. So the crescent gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, this is the time when I like to look at Venus the most, the crescent phase. Because it gets big and then it gets thin, and that's when a lot of people say you show it to them through a telescope. It doesn't take much magnification to make it look fairly large, and people think, "Oh, you're looking at the crescent moon." Like, no, looking at Venus.
Yeah, seeing Venus as a crescent and Mercury as a crescent are both very fun.
Mm-hmm.
So Venus will be hitting its peak brightness the 17th, so next week. And I believe one of our fellow astronomers said it was going to be -4.6 this time around.
That's pretty bright.
That's pretty bright.
Because the moon is, what's the moon? Is it -6 or -11? I can't remember.
I thought its absolute best was -13.
Okay, so I think an average is probably 11.
The average is probably 11,
Okay, so about as quarter as bright as the moon itself. So don't forget to look for Mars. Mars hangs around for quite a long time, so Mars will be east of the planet Venus just a few degrees right now. So swing by Venus and then flip over to Mars. It's going to be just like a small red dot. You're going to have some really excellent conditions in order to be able to crank up some power and see any detail on Mars itself. And then try sliding up a little bit northeast and see if you can pick up the planet Uranus too. So these three planets are going to start disappearing from our view within another month or so as they get too close to the western horizon and sunset. So we're going to start losing them pretty soon. So get those views in now, because coming up after that, of course, will be the planet Jupiter, which is rising at about midnight now. So something new to do some observing in. And as you remember, I've been always promoting watching Jupiter's moons, which you can find out when events are going to happen with Jupiter's moons on a website called projectpluto.com. I think it's .com or .org. Look up Project Pluto. You'll find it.
Yeah, and we had an interesting report from one of our keenest visual observers in our astronomy club on Monday night that the north equatorial band on Jupiter was bisected by different colors. So that remember several years back, actually it was probably about 7 years ago now, when Jupiter emerged from behind the sun, the south equatorial band was just, it was gone.
It was gone, yep.
It was gone for a while. It came back. Well, this time the north equatorial band is not gone, but the colors were reported to be quite different. Like there was a sort of a rusty band and then a lighter one. And so I've been looking to see if there are any reports of that hitting the news. Haven't seen any. So if you are in a planetary observer, check it out. See if you can confirm this, take pictures. That would be a really cool thing to verify.
Yeah, let us know what you see. They say we can't find any written articles on it yet.
Yeah, we'd share them, but we haven't found any yet. So if you can be the person to verify that, that would be very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it somebody that said they looked at it and saw it that way, or they read about this?
He was responding to reports from colleagues, I do believe.
Okay.
He had not seen it himself. He was issuing a call to action. So we're turning around and issuing a call to action for the whole wide world. Hey, check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's verify if something funny is going on with Jupiter.
Now, if you want the best views of Jupiter, of course, right now that would be the Juno mission in orbit around Jupiter. Which will be interesting to see also if we can look at the Juno images. That might tell us something too. Space probe right there. And I think Juno just flew by Jupiter again, real close approach, if I'm not mistaken. And they're having a little trouble with its main engine. Doesn't need it. This orbit is, you know, pretty stable. Gets close to Jupiter and then it swings out away from it. Then it's about a 2 month orbit and it swings back in close. Now they will need this engine to, they want to get it so it'll actually get closer and get some better views of Jupiter. But right now they're having trouble with the, I think it's the main engine on the mission, but still some good images. So maybe check out the Juno images of Jupiter and see if you can see if they've got any of the cloud belts and see if they've got any changes looking at it. And then after Jupiter rises, about 4 o'clock in the morning, is the planet Saturn. So are you one of those early people that will get up to see Saturn, or are you one of those people that will stay up all night to see it?
I'm not getting up at 4 in the morning to see Saturn right now. No.
No. But I've stayed
up. It's February. No.
I've stayed up to 4 in the morning, especially at our club observing site. There are a couple of observatories. Sometimes we'll not use the telescope, but throw in a heater and make it a warm-up room so it can last a little longer out there. And stayed up to see one of the planets, usually it's either Jupiter or Saturn, coming up between the trees, first views. Pretty lumpy stuff, a lot of atmospheric turbulence and chromatic aberration from the atmosphere, basically breaking up the colors. You get like a blinking red and blue trim around the planets. Not very fun to see. Not very good images, but well, technically, yes. Yeah, we saw Saturn. And that's about it. That's coming up. So Saturn should be a good one for the summertime.
Sounds good to me.
Forgot to look at what constellation it was in, though.
Yeah, it'll be one of our featured objects when we have our big public event in September.
Mm-hmm.
So I can take some time to appreciate Saturn later in the year.
Yeah, Saturn's a great public object.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one everybody wants to see. And then they see it and they don't believe what they're actually looking at. They wonder if there's like a some kind of a picture in, you know, in the telescope, which I've been tempted sometimes to actually make a special eyepiece that can hold an image with a light in it and show some planets like that. Being something ridiculous, like having the telescope inside a building and having people look through the telescope. Want to see Saturn? But I've also thought about putting a picture of a car, too, and so they can look in there and say, hey, you want to see Saturn? And then they'll see a picture of a Saturn car.
That is... I'm going to do that sometime.
Yeah, just for fun. Let's see, almost halfway point. Let's do one more news alert thing for people out there. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, there's a Albuquerque Astronomical Society, TAAS, astronomy club, like there's, you know, dozens of them all around the country and all around the world. They had a portable planetarium. I don't know if it was a Starlab brand or a different one, but it got stolen. About this. I can't remember exactly what happened.
We've got some links.
Yep. I think somebody broke into somebody's car, and I don't think they had the equipment in their car, but they had it in the storage room, and they got their keys. And they took the keys and went to the storage unit because it was marked on the keys which storage unit it was. So they went there, unlocked the storage unit, and cleared it out, which is clearing out one of the portable planetariums and some telescopes and stuff like that, too. So be on the lookout for somebody. This is probably not a professional astronomy thief.
Yeah.
More of a thief of opportunity. So let's start with the New Mexico area of the United States and keep an eye out for somebody selling a portable planetarium. They're pretty pricey. They paid like $25,000.
They paid $25,000. So when you think about anybody who's got ties to planetariums, you know, you think about the operating budget, you think about the resource, and then you think about the portable planetarium walking off. I mean, that is a bizarre thing to steal. Terrible loss for this planetarium. And in fact, as the article said, that nobody even thinks that they're going to use this gear. It's like the thieves are most likely just going to abandon it.
Right.
What are you going to do with it?
Might get pitched out. They might try to sell it somewhere, might try to give it away or whatever. But keep an eye out there, searching stuff like, you know, the usual internet sales sites.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that the Albuquerque Astronomical Society has put up a GoFundMe or anything, but if you do find a way to donate to them, I'm sure they would appreciate it.
Yeah, they did have it insured, fortunately. The deductible is still about one-tenth of the price of the thing.
But
so,
yeah, when you're a club and you're doing outreach and your supplies, because the models of planets got stolen, worksheets for all their volunteer goodies got stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So they could, you know, check it out, see if they've got a means of, you know, supporting them. And I don't know if they're a 501c3, but many clubs are. It's like, I bet they'd appreciate the support right now.
I think the arts is a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out there. Let's just start with New Mexico, and let's just put it all around the country, actually. So keep an eye out for somebody selling a portable planetarium. And get some details on it and report this back to the Albuquerque Astronomical Society.
Or if you find a portable planetarium by the side of the road.
That's true, too. So anybody out in that? Yep, you just never know. They might not know what they have completely. They might think it's some sort of a tent. They might turn on the equipment. I don't know if this is a digital one or a light bulb projection system. It doesn't say what actually type of portable planetarium it is.
Seemed like a fairly new modern one, so I think of the former.
So one of the digital ones?
Yeah. It looked big and nice.
Yeah, it doesn't say the word Starlab on the outside, which those usually do. So there are some digital ones that actually project kind of like the new modern, you know, permanent planetariums. They have a digital projector that spreads out about 180 degrees up in the dome of it. And basically whatever you can put onto a computer will project onto the ceiling. And like I said, it covers almost 180 degrees. I've seen some of these projectors before, and they're actually pretty nice. So I think that's what this one is, as opposed to just a light bulb inside of a plastic bucket, which, you know, has holes drilled into it and shoots star patterns on the sky. So I think this one is more advanced than that, but it doesn't really give any information on it. You might want to check out their website if you can find it. I didn't try looking for that, so check out the Albuquerque Astronomical Society in New Mexico, and you might see pictures of it in action. I wouldn't be surprised if they do that. Sad thing is they've got groups planned to that they were going to go take this out to.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is a massive blow to their actual outreach program.
Yep. Now they can't do that. So they've got bookings already, and they can't fulfill their bookings.
So if you have your own portable planetarium, which some people do, again, mm-hmm. you might want to send them an email.
Yeah. If you could loan them one to use in the meantime, that would be great, especially if you know that your local, maybe your local museum might have one. Sometimes a park system will have one that they don't use all the time. So maybe something can get borrowed to them, and they could cover their outreach programs for a little while till they get another one. That'd be really nice.
All right, so we've hit the bottom of the hour, Marty.
We have. So let's do a little station identification. You are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is now 9:32 in the evening, Wednesday evening, February the 8th, 2017. That's our local time here in the eastern portion of North America. So universal time, it would be 2:32 on February the 9th, Thursday morning, 2017, about halfway through our program. Don't forget, we have more programming coming up after Space Pirate Radio, so stick around for that. I have not heard, and I don't think we have Astronomy Ireland back on yet, so hopefully they will get their situation back together and be broadcasting once again. But a lot of our usual lineups are going on to Planetary Radio and Naked Astronomers, stuff like that. So keep listening in. Don't forget, our chat room is open right now. If you want to join us, come on over to astronomy.fm/chat, and you'll get to the login page. Just type in a name, hit login, and you'll be here. Be part of our Space Pirate crew tonight, and more than welcome to have you join us. We have you and me, of course. Got Black Projects, Twist Edge, Glenn Optronics, Plaid Sister, Farley, Plaid Joan, Plaid Mac, Evil Spock, Aqua for You. Everybody from the UK to Canada to the eastern portions and western portions of North America and South America also. Glad to have you all in tonight. So if you want to ask us any questions, type them into the chat room. And we'll try to read them best we can, or maybe somebody in the chat room will be able to answer your question for you too. So, we try to catch them as best we can. I haven't seen any lately. It's kind of, I find it, I always say it's hard for me to read and talk at the same time when I'm not talking about what I'm reading.
We had a good update from Black Projects that the Albuquerque Astronomical Society is getting an inflatable planetarium from a supporter. It is from the 1980s, so okay. It was not a digital one, unlike the one that was stolen, but hey, it's something.
Yep. Now, as a former planetarium person, I used to do a lot of planetarium shows, and I did sometimes a lot of portable planetarium shows. The best planetarium shows are not driven by technology, but by the person demonstrating it. So I've told people I could do a better show with stars and a pointer than some major institutions do with with a big production. In fact, we've had commentary on that. It's like our little planetarium with somebody just telling stories about the stars was actually better than the major facility, which had, you know, all sorts of PhDs and high production value and this big show that was going all over the place. They didn't understand anything, but they liked somebody just talking about the stars and stuff a lot better. So I've seen that too. I've kind of been not very impressed with some high production shows. So it's all about the presenter. You get a good storyteller.
You need a good storyteller. You need somebody who knows how to do a narrative. But that's very true about just astronomy presentations in general. I mean, that you can have some relatively basic presentations that because the teller has a good narrative, mm-hmm. everybody's paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with your local astronomy club lecture, too.
Yeah.
You get some people that are just, you know, they'll keep you on the edge of your seat, and some people don't. All right, let's see what we've got going on lately. Got some news handy?
Yeah, we have a few things. So another bit of bad news, and sorry this is a bad news night, but it's been that kind of week.
I guess so.
A NASA facility in New Orleans was damaged by the recent tornado, so there is significant damage to the facility, and this is a manufacturing plant that the space agency uses to create parts for rockets and spacecraft. So thankfully, there were only minor injuries. All the employees were accounted for, but the facility is closed while they sort it out.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a direct hit, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Do you recall?
I don't believe it was a direct hit, but it was still bad.
I've seen like a lot of parking lot canopy damage and lights and stuff like that. And I think I saw some metal siding wrapped around.
Yeah. And now the hardware that they've got there is all fine. So that's good. But there was a historic artifact that was destroyed. It was the original space shuttle external tank, the first one to ever stand in a launch pad.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
And this is one of the white painted ones. You'll remember that for the maiden flight of Columbia, her external fuel tank was white. And afterwards they decide, it burns up, let's not do that. Okay. And you have the classic look of the white shuttle with the white solid rocket boosters and the orange tank.
The orange is primer.
Yeah. Well, it's insulating foam.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the paint they were actually saving on the weight. I thought it was the primer, but maybe not.
But this was a historic white external fuel tank, and it is no more, apparently.
Just rolled across the lawn like a paper cup in a high wind.
But everybody's safe, so that's a truly important thing.
Mm-hmm. I just remember they
Sky Guy Nick from the chat room says it was the one for the Enterprise. Okay.
Okay.
That is sad. Say,
there's no way they actually had it on the launch pad to use, so Enterprise would make sense because that was landing style of shuttle. Basically, they bolted it to the top of I think it was a 747 and flew it around for checking its aerodynamics.
Right. They were going to, at one point, turn this particular unit into a functional flight tank and never did. The same way the Enterprise was at one point discussed to be turned into a space-worthy craft and never did that either.
I think that white paint actually weighed like 200 pounds.
The white paint weighed an obscene amount, yes. And every gram counts.
Yeah, so that's
dealing with space
200 pounds more equipment on the shuttle by getting rid of the white paint.
Okay, so I think that's all of our bad news for one night. So here's some good news.
Okay. Nope.
For space exploration. SpaceX appears to be back on track. They're going to be launching from the historic, I believe it is the hallowed 39A down there in Cape Canaveral, or rather at the Kennedy Space Center. They intend to be launching rockets every 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. So that was their announcement this Monday to Reuters News Services. Every 2 to 3 weeks. So that is I don't believe it's as hectic as what the space shuttle program intended in its early days, but that's still really hectic for spaceflight.
We'll see if they'll actually be able to stick to that schedule and how well it works out for them. So,
yep.
Hopefully no glitches. Hopefully it'll work well. I got a Mars article. I said I was going to do some more Mars reading and talking about Mars, too. This one is about Mars Curiosity Rover. The title is Sharpens Paradox of Ancient Mars. The paradox is early Mars and water. So they know there's been water on Mars. In fact, they still have some frozen water on Mars that was discovered not too long ago by MRO with its ground-penetrating radar. Found a whole bunch of frozen water about the size of equal to about Lake Superior here right around Michigan. So the thing is, in order to have water, you have to have a thick atmosphere, and being kind of a small planet, it would help if you had some carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, giving you a little bit of a greenhouse effect to help keep the place warm and wet. Well, they can't find the carbon dioxide. But all the indications are that there was liquid water, but you need carbon dioxide to have the liquid water stick around for a while. And there's all kinds of indications that the water stuck around for a while because of the sedimentary layers, Gale Crater and stuff like that, but they can't find evidence of the needed carbon dioxide to do that. Let me put that article into our chat room. And again, you can go to the NASA website for this too. So the question is, was there carbon dioxide? And if there was carbon dioxide, why can't we find evidence of carbon dioxide on Mars now? That would was, they thought, required to have long-lasting water on the planet Mars.
Interesting. Hey, we didn't bring this up with the space rocks and green things in the sky earlier in the first half of the show, but a green fireball blazed over the Midwest of the U.S., and it has many eyewitness reports and some really cool camera footage, including a police dash cam.
Was it green?
Yeah, this sucker is green. So
green is usually an indication of a non-natural type of
space junk sort.
Space junk. Yeah, green's usually something with copper in it.
Well, this is definitely a green explosion. Okay. And it is the American Meteor Society has collected 200 eyewitness reports from Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio in the United States, and from Canada. Most of them coming from Illinois, Wisconsin. So I don't think any of our buddies got to see that one, Marty.
Nobody that I heard of.
And it's believed that it fell into Lake Michigan itself.
Uh-huh.
So if people start selling these fragments, probably not.
No.
Don't expect legit fragments of this green fireball to turn up in your local vendors.
That's right, unless it's been confirmed and stuff like that. So especially if it's green, which I suspect, I didn't hear it was green, but I suspect space debris in a color like that. This is a good time of year. If it's a little colder, be even better for finding meteorites if there is a fall, because in the wintertime, the lakes freeze over. So if there is a fall, basically all you have to do is just start going out on the local lakes and look for rocks out in the middle of the lakes. Because the best way, well, a good way, I should say, of getting rocks in the middle of a frozen lake is from a meteorite fall. But it really takes a major meteor that people think actually broke up with witnesses, and then they kind of calculate where it probably came down. You can go in that area and see if you can find stuff. In the wintertime, a lot better because, like I said, you can go out in the local lakes and see if you can find some rocks out there. Now, not all rocks on frozen lakes are from meteors.
No, sometimes it's youpers throwing rocks at one another.
Exactly. Or sometimes it's just, like 6-year-old kids throwing rocks across the ice. Not too unusual. So be wary, but yes, it is possible to find meteorites on frozen lakes in the wintertime. Much better than one that just drops in the middle of the woods, for instance. Those are really tough to find. But this one doesn't look like it would have any potential opportunity of finding. I don't think Lake Michigan is frozen this year. I don't think there's been quite a few cold snaps, but not enough to keep most of the lake frozen. Actually, it's been too many warming trends.
Yeah, it's been really up and down. We've had some week-long cold snaps followed by thaws, so it's
when did we have December? Was really cold. Everything was like well below zero, And then it warmed up into the 40s and rained. So some of the lakes actually had like 6 inches of water on top of the ice. So it could be kind of dangerous conditions like that. So be careful.
Yeah, I was trying to think where I was that there were ice fishing shanties out. It's like, yeah, no. Not a good idea.
Uh-huh. So that's the Northern Hemisphere winter, up and down cold this year. But I've been reading some reports of Australia. We'll say hi to our friends out there in Australia, that they're expecting a major heat wave.
Oh, dear.
Going through there. Yeah.
Like they didn't suffer enough last year.
Yeah, like a super record-breaking heat wave. Mostly I looked, it was like northwest Australia. So.
Oh, Marty. Yes. This is a bit more planetary sciences in our planet Earth, but just in passing.
Okay.
This does tie into climate change because it covers climate change. So there was a long-standing debate over whether or not the Neanderthals, mm-hmm. we've talked about them a few times on the show before, mm-hmm. knew how to make fire. They used fire. We have archaeological evidence that they used fire. They had hearths. They were cooking something, maintaining fire for whatever reasons, food, mm-hmm. religion, all of the above, comfort. But it appears that they may not actually have known how to make fire because the climate periods that were warm have hearths, and the cold periods where you would think that they would be building a fire and huddling up for warmth do not. And warmer periods are more prone to lightning strikes and fires. Forest fires. So it is entirely possible, in fact, not crazy at all, that they were getting fire from pre-existing forest fires during these warm periods and making use of it. But when they didn't have access to a ready-made fire, had to do without.
Or if their fire went out and they weren't able to actually keep it, if they had to move. Usually people get nomadic because their food moves away. So if they weren't actually able to keep the fire going and travel with them, went out, then they were out of luck.
So it was quite an interesting piece of research. So
I'm thinking of
Australia and all the horrible fires that they've been through in recent years, put that mm-hmm. into my head.
Mm-hmm. I seem to remember there was some, they found some tar used to attach like a spear point to a shaft, and it had like a thumbprint in it. And I thought that was Neanderthal, but I can't quite remember. And I think the tar was made out of birch bark. I have made birch bark tar before, but yes, you definitely have to have a fire in order to do that. The process basically, it could be done with the ground, but a pot's a little bit easier. You put a bunch of birch bark into a pot and have it mostly sealed up. And if you can, like, have a hole in the bottom of it. So basically you want to heat up the pot without letting the contents inside catch fire. So you got to surround the pot. Could be maybe just clay dug in the ground done the same way too. So, you heat up the pot with the birch bark inside of it, and it will outgas a liquid, like a petroleum-based liquid, and which will go down to the bottom of the pot. If there's a hole in the bottom of the pot, it will seep through the bottom of the pot. It will collect into the ground, and then once your fire is all done, you can open it all up, and in the ground will be a blob of tar that came from the birch bark. But they said you have to have a fire to be able to do that, though. The other type of tar comes from pine trees. It's basically those little brown nodules of sap coming out.
Oh, yes. I used to play with those as a child. I thought it was fun.
Nice and sticky, and your mom never could wash it out of your clothes.
I got dunked in, not literally dunked, but I got washed with turpentine a few times.
Yes, indeed, which also comes from pine trees too.
Yeah, I don't know if that was my grandfather's kind of homeopathic, like removes like sort of way of dealing with the pine tar, but yeah, I got seriously up in some pine tar when I was a child.
Yeah, basically you just have to kind of melt it down, and there's a couple ways of treating it for purposes, so we're kind of going off into...
Now we're in botany.
It's still sciencey stuff, though. So you melt the stuff down, and you could add a little bit of animal grease to it, make it a little bit more pliable. Let's see, what else? Maybe a little bit of beeswax to it. Again, kind of makes it pliable, depending on the purpose of it. If you add too much stuff to it, it stays too soft and never hardens. If you just use a straight pine tar, it's actually kind of brittle and it doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
For some purposes that way, too.
Hey, we got a question in the chat room from Skyhead Nick on X bosons.
X bosons?
Yes.
All right, let's see, what's the question? Okay, we know X bosons can make photons decay. It's really quarks and leptons. But why does an up quark, when changing into an anti-up quark by emitting an X boson that decays into an anti-down quark and a positron, fulfill the first of Surikov's three requirements for the gut era. I'm sketching that kind of get that the guts give the prescription for turning quarks into leptons and for creating quarks and leptons from X bosons. Okay, I know the answer to this one. The answer to this one is 42. Sounds like that's a question that came from or needs to go to Twist Edge John. Twist Edge John is our guy that gets into particle physics and stuff like that. So not me. That's beyond me. So I'll just go with my answer of 42. And if you're familiar with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, you know why that answer.
Yep.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yep. You know why that came up. That's the best I can do.
Well, he's got an answer for that. He says the weak nuclear force.
Oh, it's the weak nuclear force. Oh, of course it is the weak nuclear force, which is called number 42 in my book. Let's see. Astronomers find a new class of black holes.
Well, yes, intermediate black holes.
I think this article has come up several times, but I think they have now a location for one. They had some from before.
They have what they're now calling best evidence for these intermediate black holes.
Okay, so I guess we need to explain big black holes and little black holes first. So,
yeah.
Little black holes come from stars that explode. Two types of stars explode. A star that was formed with a lot of mass, really, really big star. It burns very hot very quickly, converts hydrogen into helium, uses all the hydrogen up, basically the interior collapses, and everything crushes down into one point, making the exterior explode in a new supernova explosion. The core then shrinks down to an infinitely small point called a black hole. But it's the same, if you want to quote-unquote size, as the core of the star itself. So if you were, for instance, orbiting around that star, let's say you survive the explosion, you would basically still circle around in approximately the same spot because there's about as much gravity as there was before in that same spot. So nothing really, really big there. It's just the mass of a star. The other type is when a small white dwarf star is in orbit around a bigger star and it pulls material from the bigger star onto the small white dwarf until it builds up critical mass and the small white dwarf explodes into a supernova, and basically the same thing. The amount of mass left that makes a black hole is about the size of a star, approximately. Nothing really massive. Now, the really, really big black holes are the ones that are in centers of galaxies. I'm not too sure about how they formed originally. There's kind of some debate on how the black holes formed in galaxies originally. Maybe lots of supernovas. I've read some articles on this in the past, not too long ago, about those original black holes. Basically, I think it was maybe not a lot of supernovas, but a lot of material all in one part of the sky together. And basically, the material just crashed together and made a big black hole, which pulled down more material and kept adding to it and adding to it. I think one of the latest theories was not a lot of supernovas, but actually just a lot of material crunching down very rapidly in the earliest parts of the universe to make a giant black hole that's in the center of most galaxies. And those, now instead of having the mass of a single star, they will have the masses of millions of stars combined together. So you have to be kind of far away from them not to get pulled in. So basically it was either small black holes or big black holes. And the question was, could there be
Goldilocks black hole?
Yeah, something in between. And how would you make something in between? Exactly. There have been some discoveries of some like that, and now they think they've found one in a star cluster called 47 Tucana.
Yes, which is only visible to our friends down in the southern hemisphere, and it is not any ordinary star cluster. It is a large globular cluster, so a big spherical ball of tightly packed stars. And some globular clusters are thought, as we've discussed on other shows, to be the cores of galaxies that have had all the other stuff stripped off.
By probably interactions with other galaxies.
In fact, like ours.
So our Milky Way galaxy is probably made up of a bunch of other little galaxies. In fact, it's still consuming small galaxies. So maybe the globular clusters that orbit around a lot of spiral galaxies were, like you said, the centers of other galaxies. Maybe
galactic
small
remnants, possibly supporting other intermediate mass black holes, which is still, 2,200 times the size of the mass of the sun in the center. So there's a, it's not fully understood how the massive star that would hypothetically be in the middle of the globular cluster evolved, but there's a couple of different angles that you can look at it that are, there's a good article from Sky Intel that lays it all out.
Possibly relating to how they thought, again, black holes formed in the early universe, just a lot of stuff smashing together because it was in close proximity, as opposed to a bunch of supernovas, which we don't really detect in the early universe. So what are we down to? Our last couple of minutes.
1 minute.
one whole minute.
Maybe a few seconds more.
All right, so last little bits of information here. So this is the time we've guess it's time for us to pack it up here. I want to say thanks for everybody in our chat room tonight.
Yeah, really nice, lovely night here in the chat room with the crew.
Yep, great night. Glad you're here. We'll be back again next week. Don't forget, we'll repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours, and we still have 3 hours of other programming in between, so keep sticking around and keep listening in. Appreciate it. And don't forget, you can check for updates on Space Pirate Radio Facebook page, too, if you want to know what's going on happening on the show. We'll also put links to the show on our page too. So if you didn't have time to, click on the links, you can always go to the Facebook page and click on them and get that information and read them a little bit later. All right, time for us to get out of here. Good night, everybody.
Clear skies, y'all.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the Voice of Astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.